The bigger picture, going behind the headlines of the biggest economic and political stories of the day.
It is now time to talk to Tim Evans, Professor of Business and Political Economy at Middlesex University in London. Tim, I think we're going to start today by reflecting on the general election. It's what many people have been doing since that rather fateful day. So I suppose, first of all, we should just ask, was it a mistake to call it?
It's funny, to be honest, my wife, as soon as the general election was called, my wife said, I think Theresa May has made a strategic error. And I said, why? She's in the lead by 24%. And my wife said, I don't think it'll last. I think she'll be surprised at how her vote collapses. That's what she said to me. And I'm not really biased here, but it was the most insightful comment that someone gave me of the journey that the election actually took. She stuck to her guns and right to the end.
You might argue, of course, that the way the election was conducted couldn't necessarily have been foreseen. Many people have argued it's been one of the most cack-handed and incompetent election campaigns anybody can remember.
And I think that's spot on. I mean, my reflections on the election are many varied, many varied. And my first observation is, I think one of the things I learned was that Theresa May is not comfortable with people, whereas Jeremy Corbyn is. And this, again, has been echoed today. Both the Prime Minister and Jeremy Corbyn have visited the site of this appalling tragedy in central West London, the dreadful fire. And the Prime Minister apparently arrived, has talked to various officials, the fire brigade, the police, etc., looked at the site and announced an inquiry. Whereas Jeremy Corbyn is all over newspapers, you know, The Telegraph, Daily Mail, etc., Guardian, but he's actually with the victims and hugging them and holding them as they sort of break down in tears, understandably, in his arms. And I think the thing that really came to Sarah Pope, she's actually just not comfortable with people. And I don't remember, in modern times, a Prime Minister who was so uncomfortable with people. I mean, Margaret Thatcher would go out, you know, John Major was famous standing in sort of town squares, on upturned wooden boxes. Tony Blair would go out and meet people. Maybe the last time we had someone who was so aloof was actually Ted Heath, but even there he would go out. So the whole thing's bizarre. But here we are, Simon, and we now have a government in the UK that is being imposed on us by the Scottish Conservatives.
It's quite an extraordinary situation. What do you think actually led to it? I mean, I realise that many of the students in the country came out fairly heavily for Corbyn. Momentum seemed to get its act pretty much together, much more than the Conservatives. But from reading the runes afterwards, it doesn't seem as if that was absolutely the only problem at all. What were the miscalculations?
I think the miscalculations were that first, the Conservative manifesto was designed, it seems to me, across the board to annoy each constituency. So, for example, it was telling parents, time to worry about free school meals. It was telling pensioners, we're going to remove the triple lock guarantee. It was telling families, be very wary of the costs you'll have with social care. I mean, if you were designing a manifesto of any party to undermine great swathes of your electorate, well, they achieved it. It was a suicide note. That was absolutely on a par with the one drafted by for the Labour Party in 83. But I think there are several lessons. And the first thing is, it's the childish notion that the mainstream media are all controlling and the public will believe what they see or read. This election has absolutely blown that out of the water. And no political party, I think, can take any element or any constituency of the public for granted. If you were to engage people in an honest way and to be seen to be human, then the lesson is that will be appreciated. It will bear fruit. And for the Prime Minister to sort of be hiding from people and not to go on national television and to engage debates. I think, again, that was a huge error. Many Labour people obviously thought their leader could not win over sort of a significant section of the public, you know, but this was blown out of the water. I think, again, I mean, one of the takeaways I have is that the SNP lost votes and seats to the Conservatives because many people in Scotland actually now reject the idea of another independence referendum. I made a joke earlier about the Conservatives of Scotland imposing a Conservative government on us. There is some irony in that, but my goodness, there's an awful lot of irony in a lot of this. Another thing that came home to me is, and I was surprised by this, but the Lib Dems really are not a significant third party now. They really are not. I thought they were going to come back. I thought they were going to get 18, 20, maybe more seats. I was surprised that they've only got 12. UKIP are a spent force. They're just a spent force. Another thing, another reflection of mine, is that there were some very marginal seats where obviously they had a number of recounts. Kensington's, an example, are extraordinarily. The average house at the moment is 1.9 million, and yet the Labour Party won by 20 votes. But there were a lot of other seats where the vote seems to reflect a high level of personal support for the MP, and that the MP was returned, of whatever hue. Another reflection is that Caroline Lucas seems to have been at odds with the rest of the Green Party. She got a large vote, but my goodness, elsewhere, the Green Party vote just collapsed. As far as I can see, a lot of people talking about concern over the Brexit negotiations and Brexit leaving the EU. I don't think the result in this election can be interpreted in that way. The poll shows that the majority want Brexit to go ahead, but in this election there were a lot of issues. And my big conclusion is I think there will be another general election later this year, or more likely next year.
Well, interesting. Let's go back a little bit and talk about Labour. Parliamentary Labour Party, the MPs in the House of Commons, were fairly heavily against Jeremy Corbyn. They tried to oust him on more than one occasion. Suddenly they seem to have decided, after his performance in the election, or after the party's performance, that perhaps they like him after all. And yet he hasn't changed his policies. The policy they all profess to dislike and feel were dangerous are still there. So how do we interpret their sudden decision to come behind him?
Well, there was a very interesting piece in the Times just after the election by Phil Collins, who used to be Tony Blair's chief speechwriter. And Phil argued that while this was actually technically a good result for Labour, it was actually the worst possible result they could have in a bigger strategic sense. And what he meant by that was that Labour didn't do well enough to win. In fact, of course, they're 50-odd feet short of winning. And they weren't able to win despite the Prime Minister going down in the polls in such an unprecedented way, and the Conservative Party having launched such a clearly unpopular manifesto. Yet, on the other side, Corbyn has done so well, he's now beyond challenge, and from Phil Collins' point of view, this means that indeed the bulk of the Parliamentary Labour Party are going to have to swing behind him. And I think Phil's view is that this does not necessarily mean that if there is an election in 1 or 2 or 3 years' time, that Labour, particularly following possible boundary changes next year, which will probably add another 20 or 30 seats to the Tories, that somehow Labour are in fact going to be able to overcome this huge hurdle. Now, I don't know about that, and time will tell. But despite the failings of the Prime Minister and despite a pretty grotty Tory manifesto and an appalling campaign, even there, still the Conservatives came in as the biggest party. So, but I think the most remarkable thing about the Labour Party following the election is this, that John McDonnell on Sunday made it very, very clear that he and Jeremy Corbyn now support, in effect, a hard Brexit. That their negotiating stance is that they'd be willing to look at a hard Brexit and to stop free migration. And just as they've come out with that, indeed, the bulk of the parliamentary Labour Party are swinging behind the leadership. That I find absolutely extraordinary. And I have no idea where that's going to go. I think if Corbyn and McDonagh are really serious about getting the Labour Party to support a hard Brexit position, then I have no idea what all kinds of debates and woes there might be and factions emerging over the months and years ahead in the Labour Party, in the parliamentary Labour Party.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
I'm talking to Tim Evans, Professor of Business and Political Economy at Middlesex University in London. We're talking about Tim's reflections on the general election. I guess given that one of the reasons for calling the election in the first place was to consolidate Theresa May's position when it came to negotiations with Brexit, we should discuss what, if any, the ramifications are. Clearly, over in Europe, they must have gazed with disbelief at the result of the election.
Absolutely. And the evidence so far, with the appointment of people like Steve Baker to the Department of Brexit, the evidence is that the government are carrying on with their line of hard Brexit. Now, quite frankly, when you have the opposition led by Corbyn and McDonnell saying that they too will, if necessary, support a hard Brexit, that is the moment actually for the EU and people on the continent to be quite worried, because whilst an awful lot of journalists and opinion pollers think and have argued that Theresa May's fairly limp victory in inverted commas means that Brexit will be watered down, the fact that the Labour Party has ratcheted the debate up further and become more hostile to the EU last weekend strikes me that if the Labour Party go on whipping their MPs on that hard line, then really that you'll actually end up having Corbyn and McDonnell strengthening the Prime Minister's position on her EU negotiating hand. In a sense, that's no surprise, because just like Tony Benn, Corbyn and McDonnell have always been hardline Brexiteers. Jeremy Corbyn voted against the Maastricht Treaty, Lisbon. I mean, he's always been someone who has regarded the European Union as a kind of wicked capitalist sort of centre-right plot, and he wants out of it. The clever point for the Labour Party by suggesting that they might support a hard Brexit is they're actually, of course, strategically setting up a killing ground for the Tory party. So if the Tory party do go for a hard Brexit and start to do that, and there are economic problems, then Corbyn and McDonnell say, well, we weren't necessarily in favour of that, you know, we wanted to be part of the single market. And vice versa. And this has been pointed out by a number of journalists in The Telegraph and The Guardian in the last couple of days. The Labour Party has strategic manoeuvrability on this point. They can choose if they want to be in favour of a hard Brexit, or some of their leaders can be in favour of staying in the single market and going along with the degree of free migration. The Labour manifesto, of course, said that they were hostile to the free movement of people. And it's quite remarkable, because I'm not sure, you know, I'm in contact with a lot of students. I'm not sure how many people under the age of 30 understood that this Labour manifesto at this election had swung either to the hard left or the hard right, in whichever way you want to describe it, but had become somewhat hostile to the free movement of people. There's a lot of catching up the young have to do to keep up with the policy changes in the Labour Party. That's my point.
Many commentators have talked about the fact that so many young people were in favour of a pretty heavy socialist programme, very much hard left. And one of the problems was that they just don't seem to remember the last time we did have socialist governments or what it might lead to. And that to some extent, part of the problem has been that those people who are in favour of free markets and capitalism as being the least bad of all systems never seem to make their argument. That was the case not just in the election, but perhaps for the rest of the time as well.
Well, here we are. You know, the Conservatives and indeed New Labour spent 30 or 40 years privatising gas, electricity, water, airlines, road haulage, the petrochemical industry, Britoil, BP, buses, railways, you know, all these things have been pushed out into privatizations or contracting out or public-private partnerships. And of course, that agenda rolls forward with free schools, academies, more public-private partnerships. There's more public-private partnerships in healthcare and in the NHS. But of course, however much politicians have been involved in selling things off or involving the private sector, expectations and public demand on the remaining residual public services seem to grow ever greater. And despite all the capital receipts that the politicians have had from these privatizations, we're now living in a country with a debt of hovering around £1.9 trillion. Now, of course, Labour say they'd like to quickly borrow another £250 billion or £300 billion or whatever, and push that number well above £2 trillion. And I well understand it. If you're young, if you're at university or in your early 20s, or you're in your mid-20s, you know, and you look at property prices around the UK, and your parents and friends have told you, go to university, study hard, you know, get on the ladder. It's incredibly hard for young people. So I understand their frustration, but they're between a rock and a hard place. So they're looking for anyone who will promise them, I think, maybe even just a few years respite, you know, just a few £100 billion there, just some more healthcare, you know, some free university education, etc. But I haven't met yet someone who genuinely believes that that is a cure-all, that at the end of the 3 or 4 years, it's all going to be better. A lot of young people know that Labour are selling more borrowing for investment, in inverted commas. But very few of them believe it's going to work beyond 4 or 5 years. And when you say, well, when we do, if we do that, and we then owe 2.2 trillion or 2.3 or 2.5 trillion, at what point will the markets get jittery and will the pound sink and will you suffer inflation and you'll be back to square one just with more debt? They don't know. But I think it's a sign of people's desperation. When we're talking about, you know, the NHS or more money for schools or whatever, or less tuition fees, that's the here and now. The crucial thing is an awful lot of voters feel like lobsters. They've been put in a pot of doom and they know the water is beginning to boil. And they don't really, really trust for the long term, I would suggest, any of these politicians to cure it. If they default to Labour, it's because they think they're going to get a few years respite. That's my sense.
It does seem quite bizarre that the Labour Party talked about abolishing tuition fees without ever mentioning that they were the party that first introduced them.
Well, do you know what, Simon? I don't think that's fair.
I think
that that the Labour Party of Corbyn and McDonnell don't acknowledge really that the Labour Party was properly the Labour Party under Tony Blair. Just as I think many Thatcherites don't really look back at Ted Heath's era and say that was the true Conservative Party. To most Thatcherites, they think that Ted Heath was some sort of lefty deviation. And I think to the Corbynistas, they think that Blair was a sort of Tory imposter.
Well, talking about lefty deviations, I mean, many people would argue that Theresa May tacked to the left and then tacked to the left again during the election and talked about very few things that traditional Conservatives would consider, you know, their purview. I don't know whether you think that is fair, but we ought to talk about the future of her.
Well, I think it is fair. I think it's 100% spot on, Simon. And I gave a talk in a dusty room over a pub in Westminster just over a year ago where I said oppositions have a huge impact on governments and government policy. And I said that now you have Corbyn running the Labour Party, you will find that the Conservative Party will be enticed ever more to the centre-left. And that happened. And now, all that has to happen, and this really would be, the Conservatives won't believe it can happen, but strategists always look out for this sort of thing. What if, a year or two from now, Corbyn was to move McDonnell on, maybe become foreign secretary, shadow foreign secretary, or home secretary, and someone from the centre-right of the Labour Party was put into the position of shadow chancellor? You see, the point is that you can have a left-wing Labour Party and they entice and they inveigle the Conservatives to follow them to the left. That's what Theresa May has done. and she's fallen into that killing ground. And she's actually lost the goodwill of many of the people mm-hmm. in her party who think she's treacherous to her own sort of party and ideas. But this also provides Corbyn with tremendous strategic manoeuvrability over the months and years ahead. What if on a few fronts he unexpectedly tacks to the right of her? Now, this is exactly what Tony Blair did. He initially spent time trying to drag John Major and Hague and then IDS to the left, and they fell for it, and then Blair moved to the right. Now, I'm not... So what I'm saying is that Corbyn's had a huge impact, as oppositions often do, on the government, and the government's fallen for it and paid a huge price. Corbyn can bob around. He can move to the right for a year on economics, or move to the civil libertarian left, or he could go to the cooperative left. He could say, in future, I'd like the million employees in the NHS to actually have 20% of the equity in it and to own the hospitals and facilities in which they work. As John McDonnell said the other day, he said, I'm not just a fan of Karl Marx, I'm a great fan of G.D.H. Cole, the great Labour cooperative theorist, someone who would have loved the John Lewis partnership. Labour have strategic manoeuvrability. They are now the head of British politics, and Theresa May is a sort of dog's tail, wagging on behind. The question is, how can she get in front of the agenda and put Labour as the tail? Well, one thing is for certain, she will not do that by going to this horrendous catastrophe that's occurred in central West London, this horrendous fire, and not actually cuddle, engage, talk to, sympathise with, empathise with, encourage and lead.
But as you indicated, that is something that we're not even sure she's capable of doing. We should perhaps talk about that. We only have a couple of minutes left, Tim, but let's talk about this extraordinary blaze at Grenfell Tower, which people had apparently been warning about, particularly Residents Committee, warning beforehand about worries about fire and safety. What are the implications for this? Because the impression we're getting, I realise it's still very early days, but the impression we're getting is that this may not be something that only affects this tower, that the problems causing the fire may actually be present in many other tall buildings.
Indeed, and I think this is an absolute catastrophe. And let me put it in context for you. When we all go to school in this country, we all learn at some point about the Great Fire of 1666. And we know that 70,000 properties were lost. And we think of it as the huge, and the word is always conflagration. But actually, in the Great Fire of London, only half a dozen people died. If you look at the headline of many of the national newspapers at the moment, people are beginning to speculate that hundreds of people have died. And what I think is really interesting about this is not just the debate that you're going to have with this uber-rich Tory council, Kensington and Chelsea, and the private management company, and the Fire Act, the Health and Safety Act 1974, that was led by the Tories and then taken over by Labour, and the responsibility that that act gave to local fire services. And let's be clear, the fire brigade inspected Grenfell House only last weekend. And so what you've got is something that is a massive tragedy, even by the standards of the Great Fire of London, in terms of human life. And you're going to have a lot of politics being played between the fire brigade, their union, the Tory council, the national politicians, Corbyn, May, etc. Now, I find all the politicking around this, as a Londoner, quite disgusting. But there's going to be a lot of pass the parcel, and I don't know how much responsibility there's going to be. The last thing I would say is this, Simon. I think sometimes you get little events in politics that are emblematic, they're totemic, of a much bigger story. I remember the first week of the 1983 election when Michael Foot broke his foot, and he was plastered, and he stumbled out of the House of Commons, and the media were trying to talk to him. He was obviously a bit embarrassed. He'd broken his foot. And he got in a car, and he slammed the door, and it was so chaotic, even the trim fell off the side of the door. And at that point, I thought, this man is sunk. Watching Theresa May go round and comparing her to Corbyn, his empathy for people, his fellow feeling, his humanity, I think that the fire, the fact it happened in Chelsea and Westminster, I think it's an emblematic and totemic moment in the political life of this country.
Tim, thank you very much. I've been talking to Tim Evans, Professor of Business and Political Economy at Middlesex University.
The Bigger Picture. Going behind the headlines of the biggest economic and political stories of the day.